This is Dialogue. Dialogue, a presentation of the Public Affairs and Special Events Department of KLRB News.
This is Dialogue Assassination with Research Specialist Mae Bressel. For KLRB, I'm Gloria Barron.
Well, Mae, usually when we do these programs, we do sort of a little recap of what exactly we are doing on Dialogue Assassination. So do you want to catch the...
Yeah, every week we pick up listeners who keep wanting to go over again what the program is about, Dialogue Assassination. They listen to one show, and they wish that they got some information preceding the dialogue or the discussion we have on what the show is about. To repeat for the old listeners who I think still, some of them understand and some want us to tell them again, and for the new listeners who we pick up along the way, I'll explain what is happening with this show. I have spent 7 years researching the assassination of John Kennedy. By researching, I mean doing a job of collecting newspaper articles, books on the subject, reading the Warren Report. But the bulk of my research, the entire, what I call the pure research, is taking the witness testimony before the Warren Commission and comparing it to the commission documents of the FBI and the Secret Service and the State Department, and showing that the Warren Report's conclusions were based upon witness testimony when the witness testimony did not match the exhibits or the documents. And I spent years researching and devising my own cross-filing system into hundreds of different categories to see where the discrepancies came up, why the witnesses were making certain statements which turned out to be untrue, and why the Warren Commission chose to believe them when their staff had in their own hands the documents that would prove the witnesses were not telling the truth. They're actually under perjury. They could be arrested. They took an oath, and they were supposed to be telling the truth. But the commission isn't going to do that. They're not going to call them back because the commission didn't want to use exhibits or documents themselves. They let the FBI conduct the entire investigation on the killing of John Kennedy or the killing of Oswald, and the FBI has been named as part of the organization that was involved in the planning of these deaths. And the commission had many failures, but what I did was to spend years researching that subject. Then when Martin Luther King was killed, I found so many similarities between James Ray and the getaway car and the decoy and the use of double names and aliases and traveling again to foreign countries, like Oswald had been to the Soviet Union and back, and he'd been in Japan at Sugi Air Base, he'd been in the Philippines, and he had traveled in the Marines and out after he was in the Marines, and I found that James Ray had traveled to Canada and back to Birmingham and down to Mexico and Los Angeles and back up to Canada, and he'd been to Portugal and London, and he was on his way to Rhodesia. So these boys had traveled a lot, and there were patterns, many similarities in the two murders and in the alleged assassins. And then when Robert Kennedy was killed, I began to study that, because between those three murders, I came across 35 similarities in the pattern of reconstruction of the crime and the cover story as against the truth, and how the police department handled it and the news media's handling of these murders. So I became, I was studying the exhibits of the Warren Commission and comparing to the witness testimony. Then I began reading. I've read 8 papers a day continuously for the last 7 years, sometimes 60 magazines a month, which I cross-file and copy and put into 1,800 subject categories, which have to do with politics, because these were political leaders, and what effect they had, which personalities have gained by the murder, which ones cover it up continuously, and which lawyers are called to defend the alleged assassins, or where are they sent from? Is there a similarity in their backgrounds? So I study the lawyers, and I study the State Department, and I read articles like Evelyn Knight, who's the chief of the State Department, who says it's filled with murders and conspiracies. It just stinks to high heaven of murders and conspiracies. She's the chief of the State Department. And she makes this kind of remark. She's an arch conservative. A lot of people, Gloria, have a feeling that I'm a communist. They don't know where I stand, that you have to be a communist to undermine your government. And so I continuously quote magazines like American Opinion, because the John Birch Society and Medgar Evans, who writes every month the American Opinion, has book reviews or comments on Lyndon Johnson or Bobby Kennedy or Ted Kennedy's accident and all the world events. He continuously refers to the military coup of 1963 when the government was overthrown. And his line of thinking is more identical to mine than any writer, any of the liberal writers, certainly. You know, James Reston, Walter Lippmann, and Tom Wicker, all the smart liberals who are crying about what's happening now today. The American Opinion is the closest to my way of thinking. So my background as a researcher covers many, many books, several hundred, 109 books on the assassination so far. People don't realize there's that many. And then there's books on espionage systems and spy systems, which I've read about 100, that I own because I realized that Lee and Marina Oswald were agents of the CIA and began to study the pattern of agents and other not fiction books. These are all nonfiction, factual, espionage cases, autobiographical. So I began to study those. And then State Department books and the Pentagon story of the FBI that nobody knows, or Warfare State, and all kinds of books on government. So my background, a lot of people say, well, how can she come to these opinions? This comes, somebody made this suggestion this week, that they were in a group and they were talking about the show and the subject came up. Well, I understand some of the things she's saying, but she's making these broad statements, and how can you back them up? She's taking something in history and then taking her theories and fitting it together, because I read something in the newspaper. And that is a valid criticism. I don't object to it. In fact, I wish you people would, if that person really wanted to know what was happening in the world and felt that maybe I have something, but they don't quite dig it, I really wish they'd write to KLRB or call, just send a postcard, which most people won't do. If they want to clarify a point, they should just call in. And I don't mind the criticism, because that shows you're thinking, or you want to know, and you have a right to say on what basis are you making these statements, because I'm throwing them out about 20 an hour. I'm throwing out a lot of heavy stuff, but I have several hundred books of original research just taken from the FBI documents or letters. I make a statement that the Warren Commission had the conclusion of their findings before they ever went to work, that before the men ever met, they knew what they were going to say. And somebody may think, well, that's presumptuous. But the way the commission worked and the way I cross-filed the work, they couldn't have had it any other way. And after my research was completed, I got out of the National Archives this summer, and they just came to me this fall, 1,800 pages of documents that the commission could have worked with and didn't, that are now public domain. They cost me $92 to get, 1,800 pages that had been microfilmed and now Xeroxed. A researcher got them for me. And among them is a letter from J. Edgar Hoover to Earl Warren. And it's dated in December. I think we talked about this on another show, where he says, Dear Chief Justice, Lyndon Johnson is of the opinion that we have to assure the nation that, of two things. The Gallup poll says that people believe that Oswald was the lone assassin. There could have been a conspiracy. And this letter was dated in December, 1963. And I want you to assure the nation that, number one, Oswald did it alone. There was no conspiracy. And number two, that Ruby did not know Oswald. Now, this was before the commission had its first meeting, and the orders were given. Now, I could say that based upon my research, but now my research, over and over again in books coming out in documents, is absolutely accurate, and I can put into the book I'm writing what's coming later. So that I don't mind if people have these questions. I like them, and I'll try to answer it. So much for the background.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think, you have a newspaper clipping about Abby Hoffman.
There was a wonderful haircut. One. Tuesday morning's newspaper has an article about Abby Hoffman. He had a haircut. He said all the long hairs now are hired by Warner Brothers. The hip cult is taken over by Warner Brothers. And he talks about the young people, the hippie generation, and the problems. He said they could have done more to help in the voting system and the ballot box. They could have brought some changes. But he said now he's urging his followers to register and vote for two reasons. One is to be able to get on juries. And he said, my chief fantasy is to hang the jury of the next presidential assassin. I thought that was really good. Because they are the guilty ones, really. By letting the story not be told, future murders happen. They are the murderers. Each jury is a murderer. Because he allows the next. Of course, in the case of James Ray, he didn't even have a jury. He had a judge for 1 minute. He's begging for a jury. He can't even have it. And someday we can talk.
Do you think there's any chance that may be reopened ever?
James Ray? Well, James I got Ray. A letter from his lawyer, Bernard Fensterwald, and he's going October the 6th. I think that's tomorrow, is the day he's going down to Tennessee. And he's working very hard because James has said there was a conspiracy, just like Jack Ruby said. He said, he said, Earl Warren, if you take me to Washington, I'll whistle like a bird. You know, it's in volume 5 of the commission hearings, you know. But I don't know. I don't see how James Ray will get a chance to talk because everything would blow open. We're going to talk a little bit about how they stopped Garrison from having his trial. I just think that the young people, when the show first went on the air, we said, write letters to public officials. I haven't heard from one of them, Gloria. So we've been on 14 weeks.
We heard indirectly.
Did you get any letter from anyone?
Well, no, you did.
Yeah, the station, but not anyone really.
Talcott.
Yeah. Now, there was an article after I left the station this week. It was just the day after I left here. An article about our local community. And I want to show you why the assassinations, getting back to why we're doing these shows each week, the assassinations are not a dead issue. And they're in the news all the time. The lawyers, the case of James Ray, the Sirhan case in Los Angeles, and so forth. But there was an article in the Monterey Herald that said two hitchhikers tell of highway assaults. There were two boys hitching along our coast last week that were almost killed. One boy's name was Alan Roth, and he was picked up at Castroville, and he was dumped down near the Highlands Inn Hotel. And he was picked up and taken to community hospital where he was in intensive care. And the reason the article caught my eye is that for having followed the Manson case very carefully since 1969, I know how the pressure is coming down on the kids who are hitchhiking and moving along the roads without the automobiles that the establishment wants them to have. But this Alan Roth made a statement that was in the Monterey Herald that one of the men who almost killed him said that he had been part of the Manson family in Texas. Now, I know that this Manson family thing was concocted in Texas. My research verifies a lot of the background of the people that worked with the Manson team, that worked with the other political assassinations, and the lawyers that lop over from one to the other. And I went to see this boy over at community hospital and have a talk with him. He was a graduate of college 4 years and then did graduate work in psychology and was working at a mental hospital as a psychologist. And he was about to go into the Peace Corps for the Philippines to leave that Sunday. And he was almost killed. And he didn't have too much to say about the Manson family. But in Los Angeles, the Watson trial is going on. And we're going to do a whole show next week. If the news isn't too drastic or too shaky, I would like to do a whole show on Charlie Manson and Tex Watson, because Tex Watson's trial is going on in Los Angeles, and they don't refer to him as the hippie. All my newspaper articles of Manson, every word is hippie, hippie, hippie. But with Tex Watson, it's a different thing. A girl's testifying at the trial that he suffered no mental damage at all, that he was happy and fun to be with. He was in Texas, and he was living a very good life. His cousin was one of the sheriffs that protected him, and when he was arrested, he was confined, but he had no brain damage. He adjusted perfectly to the Texas jail and so forth. When he came to Los Angeles, he was supposed to be in a infantile position and a vegetable and losing weight and not ready to stand trial. But he was only brought to Los Angeles after Charlie Manson stood trial. Charlie Manson had a trial that cost Los Angeles $1 million. And Charlie Manson wasn't at the home of Sharon Tate or the Biancas. 7 people were murdered. And Charlie Manson wasn't in the home of any of those people. Tex Watson did all the murders. The jury knew they did them. He wasn't too sick to stand trial. And in this crazy world, if whoever is listening could only try to see things some way, like through my vision of what's happening, why should the man who did the murders not be tried first? They tried the one that they said was the robot that masterminded him. But I don't believe Charlie Manson masterminded him. And another matter is that these boys were intense racists. This Tex Watson said that he was preoccupied with a grandiose delusion to foment a race war through the slangs that would end with the Manson and his family, the families working together. This is the boy from Texas. He spoke of the imminence of a race war and that they would be out in the desert. They had a place out in the Mojave and dune buggies and things, and they would hide out until the war ended. And these men had a very careful plan. Now, Tex Watson, the prosecution claims that he purposely wore certain dark clothes to the murder site. He took his change of clothing because he knew they'd have blood. He discussed the layout of the Tate house as they drove there so that everyone would know which position. He hid his car, which was an old clunker, so it wouldn't be conspicuous in that area. He told them to wipe fingerprints off the weapons, the girls that were with him. He sent Mrs. Kasabian at the door as a lookout. He told all the people what orders to take, what to do, where they were to zero in. And Charlie Manson wasn't anywhere near this scene. He wasn't in the car. He wasn't near these people. And yet he was tried for the murder, so that everyone would know that the hippie with the fringe coat and the loose sex would be tried for the murder. Now, Watson claims that his condition deteriorated when he got to jail in Los Angeles after Charlie Manson was convicted and found guilty and given the death sentence. Then Charlie Manson said he climbed the walls of his cell and felt like a monkey. And then he added that the guards asked him, "Why don't you kill yourself?" Well, I know the guards would like Ruby to have killed himself, or James Ray, or Sirhan, or Manson. It's interesting that the guard asked Watson to kill himself, because if Watson did, then Manson would stand the sole rap, you see, before the trial. Well, Watson went a little bit loony when he was in the jail, because he was an honor student in Texas, and he was a very bright boy, and I'm sure that he was given assurances that he wouldn't even get into that jail. So he faked this mental sickness and acted like a vegetable and a mute. But the doctors watched him, and he had his tongue hanging out, and his head was lobbing over. But when the psychiatrists, you know, looked the other way and pretend they weren't looking, his head was in a normal position. He was talking with everybody. And the whole thing is that he did want to instigate a situation to bring on problems in our society which were not there before. So I have a marvelous article about Charlie Manson. I'm not going to read it now. I'm going to read it next week about this problem. But I'll read you one section of it. It was written by somebody, Marshall Singer. And one section of the Manson article said, in the early 60s, we had our own magical potions. And one was called involvement. And it could change the way things operate. Especially in the 50s, this seemed appealing. A handsome young president, ours, it seemed, held out the vision of an America that had gotten moving again, that sent its young people like Christian soldiers into the world, armed with giving a care. And at the same time, not to believe that all this was gauche, there was a sense that we had tripped upon a defect in our dream, and it was called apathy. And when Manson breaks in with us, there is a reality too complex and also too banal to understand. The article is saying that after Kennedy died, we had so much apathy about what was happening in the world. Now, Manson's friends and I dreamt up an armada against the pigs. Every car from Mojave to Los Angeles, he said, would be wiped out. And then Manson's family would beat it back. They would blame it on the blacks. They would shoot the cops and watch the blacks get the blame. After the race war and Holocaust, when the blacks and whites would be annihilating each other, the family would come out. All the talk about violence coming down from the barrel of one lone crazed assassin seems like a vaudeville routine, tolerated not because it is especially funny, because it satisfies certain expectations. John Mitchell doesn't believe it, nor does his wife, that belle of a Brunhilde with her Heidelberg drawl. For his part, it is doubtful that Charlie Manson believes it either. Conspiracy is the order of the day, both in Hollywood and in Chicago. Now, you see, we have Oswald the Lone Assassin, and then we have Sirhan and Ray. The one lone crazed assassin is a vaudeville routine, it says. And it satisfies your expectations, because that's what you want. You want to believe it's just one thing. But it isn't that way at all. And Charlie Manson knows it. He knows what he was doing, and the police know what he was doing. He had, not Charlie Manson, Tex Watson, wrote on the door of the house with the blood of Sharon Tate and the others, "Death to the pigs." They admitted they did it because they wanted to increase a race war. And the young people on our road are being pushed along, raped, kicked out of cars, threatened to be killed by a group of people riding up and down this coast, not found by the police department, using the name of the Manson group, scaring everybody. And until the real story of who bought the dune buggies, who bought the bus, who paid the gasoline for Tex Watson, and who protected Tex from really coming to trial before Charlie Manson, until that comes out, we have one more unsolved problem that's going to compound in this state. It affects our kids in this area because people are afraid to give lifts, and the kids are terrorized now. And the go-ahead is coming from a group, the same people that terrorize candidates to speak up on issues about assassinations. Incidentally, I have to say that a lot of people say, "Am I in danger, Gloria, you know, with the show?"
Yes, a number of people have asked me that.
Yeah, so far I haven't had any intimidation because of my research for about a year. But last week we did a pretty heavy show. And on Wednesday night I was out, and I have several people living at my home, and one of them came home about 7:30, it was still light, and there were two black motorcycles in the garage. And she went to the front door, and she went around the back, and the back license of the motorcycles was there. They were up against the bushes, but the neighbors took down. I have neighbors that right across the street, two houses that take down the description of everybody when I'm out, you know, if there's a car or anybody, because I call and say I'm leaving, and the car wasn't in the garage, so that they get a fairly good description of who is there. But these two motorcycles were parked in the driveway, and I don't like it. They weren't Hell's Angels, and they weren't hippies. And to me, they're a symbol like the Knight Riders. They're scary, because the man that I mentioned on another show here used to be a hippie, dressed like a hippie, who works now at the Navy Postgraduate School, who is an intelligence operation, who wasn't a hippie, rode two black motorcycles, too. They always did two cars, two black Cadillacs, two motorcycles, station wagons, the same. They travel in pairs. And also these other teams that I study work as doubles. They have identical doubles that would pass, two Oswalds, two Rays, you know, two Sirhans. A boy named Wayne resembled Sirhan. So there were these two motorcycles. I don't appreciate it. And I don't know why they were there. This person asked why you're there, and they told her, "We're looking for a street named Brooklawn." And she mentioned some street down the way that sounds like that, but it wasn't our street. And they were very hostile to her questions, and then they pulled out, and I didn't see them all week. And I hope they just stay away, because I'm really not hurting them. There isn't, whatever game they're playing, I can't hurt them. They're only going to hurt themselves, because they will believe certain fantasies that are not true, and then later they're going to be sorry. You know, who's ever feeding them? I don't know why they were there, but I invite you to stay away. But incidentally, one response to the program I got, which was really great, a woman in Pacific Grove hears the shows, and she had collections of newspapers from 1963, Gloria. And she asked me if I'd like them, the Washington Post and the San Francisco Chronicle and another one from in California, all the articles. And I said, "That's wonderful." She was saving them for her family. So I went over to her home, Pacific Grove, and I did save articles from 1963 right away, but she has all the first week of the assassination. And that's another show I'd like to do, is to take the subject of news control, because Mr. Cronkite this week is crying, and the CBS, the newsman, it's very much in the news that ever since Spiro Agnew and this administration is in, the problem of news control is very dangerous. And I would like to read the early articles that came over on the assassination, just the week of the assassination, and then tell you after 7 years' research what articles were true and what were untrue. I was reading them last night going back. I hadn't seen
that
them.
That could be probably a two-parter. It would be so long.
It would be long. I did cut out one interesting section. I didn't cut the paper out. I just copied it to show you. When we're talking about Manson and Tex Watson and the purpose of instigating the killing of seven people down there was to make it look like the blacks did it, an article in the Washington Post, November the 26th, had an article about Lee Harvey Oswald in the United States. And this is the way it reads. It said, the man accused as the assassin of President Kennedy was described by Pravda as a dupe of fascist forces. When Oswald was in turn was killed by the party newspaper suggested that the right-wing extremists shut his mouth. Oswald, as possibly, was the innocent victim of a frame-up. And at the same time, he could have been a Trotskyite sympathizer. They thought that it was possible that he was not a communist in the term of the 1963 Russian communists, but had been trained as a Trotskyite here. But Pravda went on and had a series of articles from the TASS News Service that said, in quotes, every effort was being made in the United States to launch a vast provocation reminiscent of the Reichstag Hall fire, which the German fascists needed to strike a blow against the progressive forces of Germany. Those who had placed inflammable material in the Reichstag cellars in 1933 and those who were now circulating the absurd version about communist involvement in the Kennedy assassination pursued the same ends. It is generally accepted today that the Nazis covertly set the fire which they blamed on their opposition. With every hour since Kennedy's tragic death, it is becoming increasingly clear that the assassination in Dallas was a premeditated action of fascist-minded forces. The ultra-right wing, racist quarters which plot against any step aimed at international détente, said the Soviet press. So this was in 1963, and I think we'll go to that Dan Ryder article. It also, I found in the early newspapers, November 26th, the Washington Post, an article that the Dallas police are the target all over the world. And it's interesting because when they quote the newspapers from all over, from Frankfurt, Germany, from Yugoslavia, from London, from Helsinki, from Rome, France, and Le Monde, you realize how important it was for Lyndon Johnson to get a commission going.